Exactly. It's about a reasonable, moderate approach, which is something that we all appreciate. And this leads into the next question I'd like to ask you.
Sure.
Last April, you published another book, Two Freedoms, and you talk about freedom from want and freedom from fear. So can you talk about how these two freedoms should form the basis of Canadian foreign policy dealing with terrorism, economic policy, security?
So if you think about it, and you've both had now sufficient experience with talking to people in government, you know that here's how most democratic governments work. So you have, let's take the U.S. as a good example of that. So you have Mr. Trump has just been on. Not clear what his foreign policy is. Previous government had foreign policy priorities, such as they were. Probably 30 or 40 of them in different parts of the world. And then a new government comes in. So the old priorities don't disappear. They just get moved to the side. The new government's priorities are added to the list. When you add it all up, all of them are what I call micro-priorities, and they're not being well-funded. So if you're running a major American embassy in an Eastern European country, which are the priorities that you're going to pursue most constructively? If that's an issue for America, one of the richest countries in the world, then it's even more of an issue for a middle power like Canada. So the case that I make in Two Freedoms is we should define every foreign policy goal we have by whether it is strengthening freedom from fear or freedom from want in the country that is where we're operating, and we can have a debate about how best to do that or not. And if it doesn't advance those two freedoms, it is probably a priority that on balance doesn't matter as much. Now, you will advance those two freedoms in the Czech Republic differently than you might advance them in Saudi Arabia. And you would advance those two freedoms in Malaysia differently than how you might advance them in the People's Republic of China. And you have to be diplomatic, and our diplomatic corps are men and women of great skill and background and cultural sensitivity who will know the best way to pursue it in each country. But they should be assessed based on how they're doing against those two freedoms. Because in the end, if those two freedoms fall away, they are too closely connected. People living in a country are too fearful to go to work. Think about Bosnia for the NATO intervention after the Dayton Peace Accords. If they don't think they can tie their bike up outside where they work and find it there when their job is finished, when they don't think they can put their kids in a school bus and have a pretty good chance of those kids coming home safe at the end of the day, they're not going to feel very free, and their ability to go out and work and make a living is going to be diminished. And in the same sense, if you're in a country that is terribly corrupt and honest working people can't get ahead because the Assad family controls everything, it's all being flowed to the gang, and average people don't have a chance, well, then that's going to produce the lack of hope, which means you might actually get involved with terrorist organizations. So that's how the two things connect, and I think Canada should have this as the two major symbols. Anywhere a Canadian flag flies around the world, people should say, oh yeah, we know those guys. They think that people should be able to live their lives without fear and without want, and they'll always be supportive of undertakings we take in this country to do that. They would know who we are and what we stand for. And I think that would be a much better way than having many, many micro priorities, all underfunded, none of which necessarily have any impact.
Advancing human rights, as you just talked about, it's an incredibly important and legitimate foreign policy goal. And there are times when Canada, among other nations, is criticized for kind of putting human rights on the back burner and seeking trade links, seeking economic prosperity with their neighbors. How do you think we can juggle this question of managing human rights while also encouraging economic growth and links?
So let me give you a classic example where I probably don't run with the crowd. Classic example is the sale by Canada of armored personnel carriers to our Saudi Arabian friends. So Saudi Arabia does not have a robust tradition on human rights, women's rights, the rights of dissenters, the rights of different religions. It's not a robust place where human rights matters. But the other freedom that I talked about, freedom from fear, in the Middle East, is tied to a balance of power. And if you look at the Middle East as we sit here this morning, the balance of power can be divided up this way. On one side, you have Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Assad, with Russian support. It is what it is. On the other side, you have the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, And in a funny sort of way, even though they're not part of the same family, the Israelis, who are the only open democracy in the region. The Saudis having the capacity to deal with what they're facing from Hezbollah in Yemen, the Saudis having the capacity to be strong, the Saudis having the capacity to help the Egyptians by those two naval ships, which the French, to their credit, would not deliver to the Russians after the invasion of Crimea, is a very good thing in terms of balance of power. So sometimes, and your point, if I may say so, is very well made, you have to look at the balance between the two freedoms. So I would argue that not giving the Saudis what they need to be an important military power may be justified because their human rights record isn't 10 out of 10. On the other hand, the freedom from fear that would be diminished in the region if the Saudis or the